So I'll just introduce you if that's okay. Thank you.
Do you want to have some rules?
It's a democracy.
Yeah, right.
Well, welcome everybody. I'm very glad that you could come today to this presentation. It's a very busy parliamentary sitting couple of weeks, so I know that there's a lot of people who can't come, but very shortly after this presentation, we'll put Peter's slides up on the library website, and we're also recording this session, and including questions and answers, so that recording will be up later today as well. So if anyone wants to review the highlights, they'll be all on the web and you'll be able to listen. This is the second in a series of lectures and seminars that we're having, basically on new technology and politics, particularly on parliaments in the Web 2.0 environment. Peter, I must say, has been terribly helpful because he was the one that suggested the speakers that we had last week, for those of you that were here, which gave a really, really good overall presentation and some absolutely great work that Professor MacDonald has done analysing the last election, which is a topic that's very dear to the heart of our current speaker. Our speaker today is Dr. Peter Chin, who teaches public policy and politics at the University of Sydney in the Department of Government and International Relations. His research interests focus on the relationship between information communications technology and the policy-making process. He's a very active researcher and writer, and on the University of Sydney website you can see many of his publications, including a note about his most recent article, Digital Media and the 2008 Canadian Election, which will be published in the Journal of Information Technology and Politics, and he's on the editorial board of that and the International Journal of Electronic Governments. And should you go to that website and try to sign up for a table of contents alert, it's not working at the moment, but that's sometimes I feel that's about web technology everywhere. But I'm sure it'll be up shortly so that we can get an alert when his article is up. But with no further ado, I will pass over to Peter. Thank you very much.
In retrospect, obviously, thinking about sequencing, I should have chosen some very weak speakers and that I would benefit by comparison. I've done myself a serious disservice.
That's not your barber joke.
Self-effacing, that's me. Modest. Yes. I just compared myself to Obama. It's a performative contradiction. Okay, so what I want to talk to you today about is Government 2.0. And because obviously this fits into the last one, I'll just really, you know, cut quite to the chase. I mean, certainly there's been an interest by practitioners and scholars of politics, media and communications for quite a long period of time now about, in a sense, what are the impacts going to be with regards to political practice given the kind of disruptive nature of emerging information and communication technologies. And certainly in recent years, in particular with the advent of a discourse about what's called electronic democracy in the late 1990s and now Government 2.0 more recently, there's been a shift in focus in interest in the role that information communication technologies might have in moving away from, say, process automation and dealing with the fiscal crisis of the state style things, to looking at, in a sense, the way in which technologies, platform technologies particularly, might move towards the transformation of government and address some of the kind of legitimacy crisis of the state questions that are obviously related to the fiscal crisis of the state but have other relationships as well. So I really want to discuss this notion of Government 2.0 in some detail. I'm just going to do that just basically with 5 points. First, I'm going to talk about what is Gov 2.0 and look at, in a sense, the contested and slightly ambiguous definitions that are used to define the concept. I'm going to look at the background of ICT facilitated democracy in Australia. There is quite a history of sort of projects and thinking in this area in Australia. And certainly there are lessons that we can learn from the history of our experience in Australia that shed light on the current debate about Gov 2.0. And basically, I in a sense, argue that Gov 2.0, because it does a sort of reboot kind of angle to a long-standing discussion, it actually doesn't learn from much of the history of the kind of experience that we have with public sector reform in general, but also the first wave of ICT democracy projects. Then I want to talk about, in a sense, the underlying assumptions within the discussion of Gov 2.0, and I have this sort of provocative argument that Gov 2.0 rests on a notion of liberalism that's very alien to Australia, and a lot of the underpinning metaphors and assumptions and theories that go into the construction of Gov 2.0 often that aren't articulated when proponents and practitioners talk about it are, in a sense, very classical liberal in their construction, and that has implications and problems when it's butted up against a governance system that has very little to do with classical liberalism like Australia. And we're going to look at the implications and the future benefits that we can take from the Gov 2.0 agenda if we, in a sense, are reflective about some of these underlying assumptions, some of the implications, and some of the limitations of the kind of implicit theories that proponents have. So that's my talk for today. Do you let people interrupt or...?
Yes, you normally have questions at the end, but...
Please be interrupted. I don't have much technical jargon in this, but I do talk a lot about IT industry stuff, and that might be a bit, you know, some people might want that clarified. Okay, so what are we talking about Gov 2.0? In a sense, basically, Gov 2.0 rests on this notion that the internet itself is a disruptive technology. And if we look at just, you know, one example of the impact of the internet, say, on the relationship between the internet and news media construction, we've seen that the internet has, in a sense, you know, totally undermined the economic basis of news production. And this has led to, I mean, you know, a series of cascading changes throughout the value chain for news production, the production of news, and, in a sense, the power relationship within the news industry. And this obviously has important and significant impacts for the way in which news is constructed. So if you look at surveys of Australian journalists, there was one done a few years ago in Queensland. Within the last decade, there's been a complete reversal in the work of journalists in terms of their reliance on the information subsidies of PR material. So whereas journalists once created information themselves through their own work, now they're increasingly required to produce more copy with fewer resources for more formats, and that has meant that they're increasingly reliant on PR press releases and material like that. And that's just one impact. If we look at a whole range of other areas, social relations, where our social capacities are facilitated by ICT, Facebook allows us to maintain friendships that we couldn't maintain before. You know, how many people go onto Facebook and discover all these old friends from school and stuff like that? Once upon a time, if you went away, once you finished school and university, you got new social networks. You didn't hold on to those old social networks except for a few core friends. Now we can maintain, but also modify those social relations. So we informationalise our social relations. We know the performance of our friends in terms of how many we have, how many are pending, how many posts they have to our walls, how many times they like or dislike things that we have to say. So we've gone from, in a sense, one sort of social relation where we understand our social environment through gut feeling to the ability to turn our social networks into databases of information. That obviously has impacts for juries, we've seen recently, and a range of other things. And obviously the economic area, the production of new goods and services is an example. So we have, in a sense, a disruptive technology, and this obviously then leads us to thinking about this notion of how will this affect politics? And to a large extent, and as a person who's done a lot of study of the political impact of new technologies, we have to say that the evidence is largely that it hasn't been a significant impact. Like, there is no real equivalent to the Facebook impact on social relationships to the political world. In the United States, we've seen impacts like the rise of micro fundraising by the Obama campaign. But if you look at the broad nature of a lot of the political campaigning, it's still, you know, relatively the same. Obama may have had a radical web-based campaign, but actually most of his money still came from relatively conventional techniques. It still was a very centralised campaign strategy. It was not a distributed, new media-enabled campaign in the way that Howard Dean's campaign was. So certainly not at the kind of fringe, you know, bleeding edge of technology that some presented. But I think there are important impacts on politics that we'll see emerge from the introduction of new technologies in general, and also their uptake specifically programmatically in terms of activities like Gov 2.0 that governments and parties and political activists might start to engage in. Gov 2.0 itself
was predicated on another socio-technical change, a pre-existing socio-technological change. It rests very heavily on the notion of Web 2.0. Web 2.0 is defined by Scroth and Janna, a bit of a technical definition here. They talk about more of it as a philosophy of web design to create internet applications that deliver mutually maximising collective intelligence and value-adding for each participant. And if you think about it, that's an incredible claim to the power of a particular type of web design. Most of us think about it in terms of the read-write web, and we can see how examples like blogs and Wikipedia are incredibly generative in their capacity to distribute and disaggregate content creation, create new forms of communities of interest. That changes the entire dynamics of the way we understand information. For some, it creates the notion of the cult of the amateur. Okay, so you know, Wikipedia itself, you know, flourishes on the back of amateur activity, whereas Google's competing service, Knoll, which tried to recruit experts like myself, is far less successful in that. But we also see how, in a sense, it kind of inverts some of the social power relationships that we're used to in society. So, for example, the notion of the production of content itself was once you'd prepare, you'd edit, it'd be scrutinised, and then it would be published. The social media invert that, and now we have you prepare, you publish, you rely on social filtering, social editing, and then it gets to an audience. Very different notion of the relationship for power. There's an interest in this area. The Australian government sets up the Gov 2.0 task force to think about, you know, what is Gov 2.0, how can we apply it to improve democratic practice in Australia. They come back with a very enthusiastic report in the last year or so, and they define Gov 2.0 as a public policy shift to create a culture of openness and transparency where government is willing to engage with and listen to its citizens and to make available the vast national resource of non-sensitive public sector information. Government 2.0 empowers citizens and public servants alike to directly collaborate in their own governance by harnessing the power and opportunity presented by the technology. What the task force itself do is they focus on three particular areas that they say define Government 2.0. First is obviously the cultural aspect, transparency and openness, the explicit use of Web 2.0 like blogs and wikis to enable that generative capacity by government, and the release of public sector information. Now, I guess in this way, I think it's useful to note that Gov 2.0 itself may have strong predication in technology industries where the Web 2.0 idea comes from, particularly the writings of O'Reilly, who I'll talk about a little later. But in a sense, it's also related to the kind of concepts of new public management that emerged with people like Moore, who talked about the creation of public value, using, in a sense, private sector entrepreneurial techniques to create public value by drawing bureaucrats, public servants, out of the background of policy-making processes, putting them in the foreground, seeing them more as active managers, moving politicians more into the role of being a board of directors that review and oversight in a much more indirect sort of way. It also has a strong relationship to pragmatism and the notion of the third way. This third way aspect obviously picks up those ideas about public-private partnerships that were particularly powerful, particularly in the early days of the Blair government. And you know, the chief kind of proponent of Gov 2.0 in the United States, Tim O'Reilly, draws upon examples from the private sector to illustrate what Government 2.0 can deliver. Because obviously Government 2.0, as not being a process of government automation but of transformation, has complexities that are not easily articulated in terms of simple, you know, all you've got to do is rewire the back end. There's a much more complex kind of language that goes on. Now, what I'd say is one of the reasons why the Gov 2.0 is set up, and also most of its recommendations are picked up by the government at the time, was that the emphasis on this co-production, public-private cooperation, entrepreneurialism does fall on very fertile ground in Australia. So Lindsay Tanner, one of the ministers responsible for the task force, in his 1999 book, Open Australia, talked a lot about technology in that book. He unfavourably compared the capacity of public servants to provide correspondence to members of the public with
fast food companies and their ability to service the public rapidly and quickly. And more recently, in talking about Gov 2.0 in 2011, he reiterated that Gov 2.0 is useful for Australian government in that it picks up on lesson drawing from sectors with strong traditions of innovation, so particularly the IT kind of sector. Okay. But what I'd say is this is obviously not the first time that we've had this sort of discussion, and a lot of the ideas, particularly in terms of talking about the problems of Australian democracy, particularly participation problems, which I must kind of point out, and it's not in the paper, which will be online as well, I believe, that in a sense, the problems of Australian democracy in terms of the decline of democracy hypothesis, citizen disengagement with the political process, is taken as a given. It's never really articulated that that is necessarily the truth. And certainly many of us rely on indicators like the ANU's Australian Electoral Study to illustrate the decline of participation in political parties and contacting politicians as evidence of the decline of public participation in government. But I'm not sure that that's actually necessarily the good indicator we think it is. It certainly picks up a decline in traditional forms of public participation. It doesn't actually measure new forms of public participation in non-institutional kind of structures. But anyway, so a lot of the debates and concerns about the citizens not being active participants in government, a decline, apathy are picked up previously by debate about what we call e-democracy. And e-democracy, in a sense, was a subordinate debate, particularly during the years of the Howard government, in a larger debate about the use of ICT by government, which largely focused on, in a sense, the automation of government services. And it's safe to say that regionally Australia was seen during those years to be a leader in electronic and online service delivery. But one of the areas where we didn't take a strong lead was in the area of electronic democracy, the use of new information communications technologies to either automate or create new democratic practices. A lot of the initiatives that were undertaken, particularly at the state and local levels in Australia, were seen as underperforming particularly. They tended to be what we could call programmatic e-democracy initiatives. They tended to be top-down and delivered like electronic and online service delivery initiatives. So we would deliver an online petition system. We would create an online forum where people would naturally come and participate. These were deemed not to be generally successful, largely because of low levels of participation, but I'd say actually really because of excessive risk avoidance by the people who planned and delivered them. And that was really because of a not unfounded fear of system misuse, say trolling or spamming forums, for example. There was a tendency for those initiatives to be kept within the government domain space rather than be placed within non-government organisations or community organisations which already had constituencies who might be interested in particular policy areas. But the most significant reason was a real reticence on the part of policymakers to engage. Very few of them were strongly tied into the policy development process, and they never left the pilot stage. Because they'd been constructed as programmatic e-democracy, citizens often saw them in instrumental ends. If it's an instrumentally delivered democracy initiative that's unconnected to policy making, why would you participate in that process? Because it doesn't connect to the endpoint, which is an effective policy kind of process. My argument, and in a nutshell, would be that this is really the result of very poor lesson drawing, particularly from people like Stephen Clift, who came out to Australia in the late 90s, early noughties, quite a fair bit. He talked about his Minnesota e-democracy initiative. So basically, in a sense, Gov 2.0 has an opportunity to re-kickstart this area of inquiry, not simply because we could argue there's an unrealised potential for ICTs to have more of an impact on politics than they already have, but also because, in a sense, there's a new thinking about what sort of online political communities we might create. So when, in a sense, people were talking about e-democracy at the turn of the century, it still sounds funny, doesn't it? People like Dalbo, for example, they tended to talk about initiatives like the programmatic e-democracy initiatives, so online consultation forums, for example, as examples of placemaking by governments
creating new public spheres. But more recently, that has kind of developed to looking at, in a sense, the use of social media, blogs, wikis, Twitter, those sort of things, as in a sense co-opting natural public spheres that emerge instead of actually trying to create places. More recently, Murray has talked about the contemporary internet, not the spaces we create on it, but contemporary internet as a new public sphere in Habermasian terms. So a place where political discourse may more freely be exchanged between the proletariat and the bourgeois, and one where, thanks to the pseudonymity offered, speech is less susceptible to chilling effects. This attractive prospect has encouraged many academics to discuss the virtual public sphere as an extension of Habermas's original public sphere. And this, in a sense, gets to the guts of my critique about Gov 2.0 and the way in which it's presented as providing the capacity to create a new public sphere for the formation and mobilisation of public opinion. Essentially, the problem I have is that a lot of people who talk about the internet as presenting a new public sphere often do so without really any elaboration of what the public sphere means. And the notion of the public sphere itself is very problematic, particularly because the idea comes from Jürgen Habermas's work translated in English in the 1990s. It's a work of history, it's not a work of political science per se, and the public sphere that Habermas talks about is a historically defined one. It exists only for a very short period of time. So what Habermas says is really that the rise of the educated bourgeoisie sees the development of a culture of public engagement supported through emerging journalism. This process rests on Enlightenment rationalism, that is the notion of that truth, vis-a-vis John Stuart Mill, can be derived through discourse rather than given by institutions like the church. The educated and time-rich bourgeois class, according to Habermas, is able to gather and reflect on issues of public concern in salons and coffee houses to determine their shared public interest. Okay, so this requires a number of things. First, it requires the end of monarchical rule. It also requires the ability to create a consensus on what is the public good. In addition, the notion of the public sphere and public opinion is not synonymous with our contemporary notion of public opinion, which we see as the aggregation of all individual opinions. The public sphere only really comes into play, according to Habermas, when people engage in rational debate, determine what their ultimate objectives of government are, and mobilise to act on those. Now, the limitations of this concept are quite broad. Certainly, Fraser was an early writer who talked about the very class and gender-specific character of the bourgeois public sphere and how it represented only a small group. This is actually not a criticism of Habermas's theory, per se. It's actually a criticism of the notion of the bourgeois public sphere and an idea of government based on negative liberty in toto. The public spheres of Habermas's historical review were exclusive men's clubs, and their ability to form a cohesive set of opinions about government, what government should do, was based on a comparatively narrow definition of the public interest. For a small, emerging class of professionals and business people, the development of a minimal state that ensured the provision of key public good infrastructure, a system of laws and rules to allow citizens to engage in trade effectively, contract law, was all that was needed for this class of people. So it's not surprising that this period of time, this very specific period of time where we see the rise and eventual decline of the bourgeois public sphere, coincides with the rise of the ideology of capitalism as a meta-ideology, which influences views of what's good or right. Now, the important thing for people who want to employ this notion today is that Habermas also has a prescription for the decline of the bourgeois public sphere. And what Habermas says very clearly is that as soon as we move from the minimal state, the minimal liberal state, into the modern welfare state, where we put spoils into the public domain, as rational choice theory tells us, this encourages people to go into the public sphere to compete over economy. okay, to compete over things that were once actually within the private realm. And you've got to remember that at the time of the creation of the bourgeois public sphere, production does not occur in public companies in the public realm. It occurs in the private sphere. So men would go into the public sphere to talk about public interest issues with no encumbrance, okay, with no personal encumbrance that they needed to get spoils from the state. As soon as the welfare state is created, it places spoils in the public domain. And that, according to Habermas, undermines the capacity of the public sphere to create the public good, the public interest. Okay? Now, Australia was born modern. It has no period of classic liberalism. So the notion of government 2.0, which rests very strongly on the implicit assumption of a very specific historical type of public sphere, as discussed by Habermas, is entirely alien to our experience. It's questionable if ever a period of time existed at all in its pure form, but it certainly never existed in Australia. In addition, what I'd say is, because we're born modern, we have to recognise that we are social in the way that Hannah Arendt talked about, the rise of the social. So Hannah Arendt says, the rise of the social sees economic production put into the public sphere. As soon as that's put into the public sphere, all those things that used to be valorised within the public sphere, public debate, public service, are pushed into the private sphere. And what Arendt says is that this makes excellence anonymous, emphasises the progress of mankind rather than the achievements of men, change the context of the public realm beyond recognition. So she's talking about the end of liberalism here, okay? Now, the upshot of this is, while we like to talk about public spheres because they have this, you know, historical echo, warm cosiness, coffee shops, you know, chaps talking to chaps about things of importance, rationalism, enlightenment kind of theory, public opinion today has got nothing to do with the public sphere. It's about the marketplace of ideas. And this is, you know, reiterated through our use of public opinion polling, which in its contemporary form, through forced choice ranking and methodological positivism, is a technique that takes opinions which may not be firmly held before the question was asked, and it reifies them. And you've got to remember that when public opinion polling was invented less than 100 years ago, what people were willing to participate. Today, public opinion polling companies do everything they can to beat up their sample sizes because very hard to get participants. So they used forced choice ranking and they reify opinions that may not be very strongly held. And this is why we can see public opinion shift dramatically over time. It's not because public opinion is shifting, it's because it's methodologically unsound. So as Cass Sunstein observes, aggregate or marketplace notions disregard to the extent to which political outcomes are supposed to depend on discussion and debate or a commitment to political quality and on the reasons offered for or against alternatives. And we see in that everything going on. The decline of political discourse, the decline of reason, and the notion of political equality. Okay, so let's shift away from political theory for a second and just sort of move to, in a sense, the implications that has for Gov 2.0. So we'll bring it back to the kind of concrete. How long over time? 10 minutes?
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay. So basically, the upshot of this, I would argue, somewhat uncritical adoption of the notion of Gov 2.0 is that it has a number of implications that come with it. So Heeks, for example, who's looked at, in a sense, government technology transfer projects, talks about these projects as carriers of context and looks at the way in which often first world projects that are moved to developing countries fail because of the fundamental underlying shared lack of assumptions. And so we see, you know, payroll systems introduced into Bangladesh that no one will use and things like that, because the assumptions that underpin those about the way in which particular organisations will work culturally or whatever don't exist in those areas. The problem I have with a not well thought through Gov 2.0 follows Lessig's argument that code is law, that in a sense some of these kind of technical solutions can structurate outcomes in particular ways. And I'll give you a very good example. Facebook doesn't allow you to unlike things. It only allows you to like things. It only allows you to engage in a particular way,
with content that comes through your social network. That is the way in which that system is designed. It provides a particular structure. It facilitates but also controls what you can achieve. Okay, so what are the implications? Four points that I'd just like to make. First is, and I say the implications, I say they're points but they're actually criticisms. Right? Because I was trying to be provocative. And not just bad-tempered. Okay, the first point for consideration. So I've got this written down. First point for consideration. So, with all due respect, GOV 2.0 is the way GOV 2.0 constructs citizenship. Citizenship is fundamentally participative. The public sphere is a site of freedom as seen by Arendt, i.e. as seen by Arendt in a period of time that never existed at all. This tends to get picked up by writers very strongly, particularly from the American context, because it meets with American liberalism. The American notions of liberalism, particularly the work of Dahl, which talks about people who may not engage with public life, the apolitical strata, as Dahl said, as being fundamentally satisfied, because the barrier between non-participation and participation was incredibly permeable, and it's obviously just a rational economic metric that one makes about participating in politics. So if you don't participate in politics, obviously you're satisfied enough with the system. That is a significant assumption to make about, one, the degree of frictionlessness GOV 2.0 will bring to political participation if introduced, and two, people's motivation and understanding of politics. Second, the flip side is, in a sense, what GOV 2.0 sees as the role for government. So O'Reilly, in his discussions of GOV 2.0, tends to use this formulation. He talks about government 2.0 as a platform. Okay, government becomes a platform in this environment. And so government shouldn't be seen as providers, or regulators, or arenas, our classic kind of metaphors that we've used for government. They should be seen as Web 2.0 platform providers, like Google, or Facebook, or Apple. And this approach talks about, in a sense, the capacity of government as being a platform for human activity and human achievement to emulate the success, and this is very explicitly made by people like O'Reilly, of projects like the Wikipedia, the Linux operating system, the ability to use a technology that allows for coordinated volunteerism to create goods of extreme public value. Don't get me wrong, these are goods with extreme public value. And if government becomes a platform, it becomes an enabler for people to come together, solve their own problems, create public goods, then government is being successful in that way. Now what I'd say is, first I would quibble with the examples used. So often examples like Wikipedia or the Firefox web browser or the LibreOffice or OpenOffice productivity suite are used as excellent examples of the generative capacity of the open source model of production. But what I'd say is they are very bad examples. None of those actually started as pure open source projects. They all started as conventional projects, or they ran parallel to conventional projects, Newpedia, Netscape Navigator, StarOffice, and then were opened by the organisations that began them. They did so for very specific commercial reasons. Google supported Firefox for a long period of time to encourage the development of better web browser software. And Sun supported OpenOffice basically to reduce the market dominance of Microsoft's cash cow products. Its cash cow is its Office suite. Sun attacked its cash cow by providing a free product suit supporting the OpenOffice suite of software. In addition, the generative capacity of the projects that are often cited are commonly associated with ad-hocratic organising models. These ad-hocracies have a number of strengths and weaknesses that we need to keep in mind. Yes, they can be very effective for projects that can be broken down into a series of discrete tasks and allocated to a large group of participants. The Wikipedia model is an excellent model of that. Each of the various parts of the encyclopedia can be broken up. They're terrible at producing coordinated, consistent, or products that require an auteur's view, for example. So the Wiki book, A Million Penguins, the most edited, least read book ever written, largely described as entirely unreadable, because obviously it's not the sort of project that works. Now, what is attractive about Adhocracy, obviously, is it attracts people who have a what works type perspective, and so we commonly see participation by what Henrik Bang would call the everyday maker style of citizen. A very particular sort of citizen who's interested in, yes, achieving specific instrumental outcomes through participation in the state, but engages in hit-and-run activity and does not maintain long-scale and long-term connection to government or government process. And what I'd argue is because Adhocracy de-emphasises process and leadership, this is particularly problematic for government and the government sector, particularly in places where resource allocation and legal proceduralism are required, i.e. most of what government does. Also, it's been noted that most of the uses by government of autocratic systems of management have been during periods of exception, so after disasters or emergencies where the normal rules don't apply. And if you think about that, a lot of the tech companies that O'Reilly will use as examples do display very adhocratic systems of governance, but often they're incredibly problematic. Apple, for example, one of O'Reilly's favourite examples, has a very ad hoc way of dealing with its complaints against censorship of content, including the censorship of classic literature because of adult content, and the refusal to publish political cartoons. And this is in the context of the United States with their strong First Amendment provisions. And in addition, arguments that the internet by nature automatically disintermediates, automatically forms a more direct connection between the metastructure and the citizenry is a dubious one. And Apple again, the Apple iTunes, the App Store, for example, is a classic example of the re-intermediation of that supply chain. Third, what I'd say is it's very unclear what success means in terms of Gov 2.0, particularly if our model is the Web 2.0 environment. In 2007, if we said, what is the best example of a Web 2.0 initiative, we would cite Flickr. Flickr is now dying because of social flocking that we see online as people move all their photos to Facebook. The tech industry has very little sense of history, where governments have a lot of history. And we can see that there are good examples that this is obviously problematic for government. Yahoo, for example, on a dime can turn off GeoCities and just take a lot of content off the web when it becomes uneconomic for it. But the State Library of Victoria still has to maintain the MC Squared web hosting initiative, mired in the oldest of proprietary code because it can't stop providing a service that is now entirely antiquated in terms of its technology base. So Riley tends to talk about the best examples of platform providers as just those who happen to be the most successful IT companies today, right? So he says, every big winner has been a platform company, someone whose success has enabled others, who built their work and multiplied its impact. Microsoft put a PC on every desk in every home. The internet connected those PCs. Google enabled the generation of ad-supported startups. Apple turned the phone market upside down by letting developers loose to invent applications no phone company would have ever thought of. In each case, the platform provider raised the bar, creating new opportunities to exploit. What I say is, obviously, that's problematic in terms of it sends a very, very specific snapshot of time to judge success, but also the analogy is really weak. Very few of the companies here are really the most of platform companies. Google does not, for example, release information into the public domain. If you want to gain Google Act information, it will provide it to you, but not in a machine-readable way, not with axes that allow you to do comparisons. Microsoft, for example, wasn't a platform provider. It asked other companies to be platform providers to make standardised hardware that its operating system would run on. It used others' platforms to add value to its proprietary code base. And through it, gained dominance in the Office Suite and used its proprietary Office Suites to become a monopolist. These are not the best examples in the world. It also implies that platforms are obviously participative, and I don't think that's the case. Certainly, Apple's ad hoc responses to the content that it allows through its App Store is problematic, and also is problematic in terms of democratic participation. Apple does respond by winding back decisions it's made when people complain about censorship decisions, but in a very uneven manner. For example, when it comes to adult content, it has a tendency to respond to contents about heteronormative material, but not about homosexual material, for example. And the final point really is what I'd say is that the approach doesn't really learn very good lessons from previous examples. A good example is obviously recent criticisms that in the US, their Gov 2.0 initiatives to release a lot of data have been token or compliance only. And I think it's obvious for anyone who's done a small amount of study in public sector management to get a sense that calls to release large amounts of public sector information into the public sphere is going to be problematic in the sort of risk-averse environment that politics is. The work of Schnell, for example, shows how a lot of the well-meaning parts of the freedom of information laws were undermined by the fact that the data, as soon as it was released under those laws, was almost immediately used by journalists and members of the opposition in the most sort of punitive way. And governments quickly pulled back, and public servants who went out on a limb to meet the kind of best sort of practices of being open and transparent often did so at their own risk. The final point I'd say is I'm just not sure that that actually Government 2.0 really does emulate the strategies that the dot-com heroes present. So I talked about Google does not tend to release its information, and also when private sector companies have done the sort of wide-scale public interest data release, they've quickly run into the sort of predictable problems that governments are going to deal with. AOL in 2006 released 3 months' worth of its search data for researchers to use, theoretically to get better search algorithms out of. They had not done the sort of process that I think a government agency releasing a large amount of data would have done. Quickly that data was reverse engineered and individuals were identified out of the search results, even though it was de-identified. Very few of the examples used Apple, Google, Microsoft engage in any of the activities that we see in terms of transparency. Apple is an extremely secretive organisation. Google doesn't release its data. It certainly doesn't release its secret source. The participation and democratic character of these organisations, I think, also can be questioned. Okay, just very finally, three things I'd say, because I've been very harsh. There is obviously great benefit to be gained from new technologies. If we reflect upon them at maybe a slightly deeper level, I think we can get some of that value. Three suggestions. First, obviously, we need to think about capabilities. A capabilities approach to dealing with citizenship is important. Carol Johnson has started writing about how recent Labor government administrations through projects like the NBN, but particularly things like the Laptops in Schools initiatives, have begun to look at capabilities. And maybe that will create some of these more frictionless participative environments that we see. I would warn, based on a lot of experience we've had with attempts to overcome information disequalities in society, that often these broad-scale general projects do, you know, rise all the boats equally, but retain the relative distance between people at the top and lower ends of the socioeconomic spectrum. So we have to give considerable consideration to what minimalist levels of participation we can expect are and how far they might be from the maximalist view. And if Gov 2.0 only increases the distance between the minimalist level of procedural democracy and the maximalist level of democracy and participation you can engage in, we can't say that's a positive, because we know empirically that the most disequal societies are the societies that fare the worst in terms of education, health, employment, and democratic outcomes. And we see that emerging in countries like the United States, the UK, and unfortunately Australia. Secondly, obviously, we need to think about pluralism. A lot of the discourse about Gov 2.0 is framed in terms of citizens, but actually very few of the projects that we see around the world are embedded within groups of citizens. They are actually institutionally based. Australia, as I've said, does not have a radical individualist political history. And so we have to think about how we might cultivate relationships with organisations and institutions who will likely be the intermediaries for these sort of projects. And the final point is, and I think this is the more general point, nowhere in the Gov 2.0 literature really, other than a technological determinism that by having a blog you are more open and transparent, is there any explanation about how and why greater transparency comes out of this process. And clearly that is obviously at the root of the problem. What we've seen with the FOI legislation has not been a failure of the capacity to write legislation or the capacity to store and retrieve documents. It's not been in the technical side of things at all. It has all been within the culture of political process, the adversarial nature of politics, and the realpolitik of the way in which information is used. And unless we spend a fair amount of time thinking about that cultural aspect, we're not going to go very far. I went too long. Thank you.
Thank you. One interesting range of issues, I must say. I was very pleased to see Hannah Arendt used absolutely. Are there some questions or comments?
I'm totally persuaded by your last remark. The big issue is it's largely a cultural one, and the whole issue of risk averseness and all that sort of thing. So that's a lot. I can't see how that cultural shift is going to change to the extent that public servants can, without fear, participate in the way that online participation requires now, and that with that speed and that, because they've got to check back with their political masters and all that sort of thing. I can't see ministers becoming any less or any more willing to take those sorts of risks when they know that if something goes pear-shaped, they're going to get crucified. Can you just talk through?
I think that's a really good point. Mark Moore talked about the public value back in the 90s, and public value's idea was, in a sense, that public servants managers, okay, so this is slightly high level, would become public value entrepreneurs, and they would be let off the leash to create public value, right? And in a sense, they would then build constituencies with their service recipients that reauthorise their creativity. Now, when you read that in the Australian Westminster context, you get a chill that public servants are building political constituencies that allow them to insulate themselves against their ministers, right? That's how I read that. Now, obviously, that happens all the time, of course, but it's like not something we say you should actively do. I think but that was in the 90s. If we go to today, I guess there are two things. One, does WikiLeaks say, well, in a sense, there are no secrets anymore? And I'm not sure that's the case, but anyway. WikiLeaks is not a direct thing. It's also heavily it relies more on newspapers than being a direct channel. But does the culture come automatically if you can't keep secrets very well? And if the volume of, in a sense, discussion and dialogue goes up, does that reduce the gotcha moments, for example? So as we see the frequency emerge, will that kind of reduce it? So if we think about the parliamentary expenses scandal in the UK recently, we're not going to see that again. I don't think we're going to really see that again. Politicians are getting the point, like, if that information is kept somewhere, it's going to come out. Now, what I'd say is that's not Gov 2.0. That was old-fashioned FOI, very old-school FOI. But it was FOI undertaken not by an opposition, not by the Daily Mail, by a citizen. I think there are some interesting ideas in Government 2.0 about the role of citizens and how citizens can engage with some of these places to interface. What the Government 2.0 advocates would say is this is less about oversight and more about co-creation and generation. And because that will then deliver benefits, right, then in a sense politicians will be happy. And the example we might use is the C-click fix one. So a company in the United States creates a website called C-click fix. You've got your GPS iPhone, you're walking down the street, you see a broken pavement, which is a trip, click, send, GPS data off, your local government gets it, we're going to fix that, you get a report back, you get stars based on what a good citizen you are, and it's a gamification. It's now fun to be a good citizen. They're getting information, they don't have to rely on just their staff, they fix these sort of things. Now, the first thing you go is, well, who's walking around with iPhones that have GPS and are going to do that? So there's obviously that social risk position aspect to it again. But those things are becoming much more ubiquitous. The second is, you know, if that's seen by the government as being a win, then that, in a sense, transparency, because you can see the performance of all the different participants in councils. You know, you've got lead tables written all over it, but, you know, maybe that's a good thing. Maybe then they come on board with some of that. The other thing is, governments have got locked into a modernist mode of communications in recent years. And the state of the art is the PR state that Ward has talked about a lot. I would argue that the PR state is part of a model of communication that is dying. So whether the state of the art will last in terms of there are issues, you can manage them, that will be an effective strategy. Because most PR people say they bury more stories in their report. But that's obviously from a context of scarcity. We don't live in a context of scarcity anymore. And that's where the inversion issue comes in. So I think there's potential here. I don't think I answered the question. But I talked about a lot of stuff, though. And in terms of the new ASC process, it's all quantity, not quality. So I'm doing well.
One of the points I thought I'd make was from some research we've done as part of developing the new Parliament House website. We talked to senators and members and their staff about what their expectations were for communication,
yeah,
the use of Web 2.0, and one of the things that messages that came across very clearly was that they believe they have different personas, so that there's a persona in terms of a representative in the Parliament. After yesterday's behaviour in the House of Representatives, I'm not quite sure how far I can take this analogy, but one which is of substance, of structured communication through inquiries that the communities are encouraged to communicate with, and they want to go out and speak to people, not just online.
Mm.
Then there's a different persona, which is, if you like, the political personality, where they're going for votes, they want to have really structured online communication, where they're developing issues with a different culture than they see in the parliamentary presence.
Yeah.
And then a third one where they have a presence which their political party seeks to control, which is clearly one where the barriers between their political presence and the party presence is a closely fought and continually fought battle.
Yeah.
And I thought that gave me some different insights into thinking about Web 2.0, and that it's not... Parliament has many roles in making policies and making decisions. Government have some roles, and we seem to have a number of different arenas,
mm,
different platforms, which inevitably will have to be part of the way we work. But the sort of creating the new culture won't be happening in the parliamentary one because of the nature of communication at present. But maybe we see some breakthroughs in the individual parliamentary presences.
Yeah, I think that's possible. I mean, the flip side, of course, is that a lot of these personas are getting mushed together.
Yep.
One of the things that, you know, the eGov people originally used to say is, oh, look, this will be great for narrowcasting. The problem is, of course, it isn't. You want to say something to one constituency, it's all the bankers, right? Next thing you know, everyone knows about it, sort of thing. I mean, you can't even put a photo of your erect penis on Twitter anymore without everyone signing it. Like, you know, the days where you could do that. I mean, frankly, it's a loss of parliamentary practice. But so on the one level, yes.
Yeah.
On the other level, no, that's really difficult. And I think members particularly are getting picked up in the speed of this, and they are losing control over this. And I think a good example is the Twitter sort of thing. I have used Twitter for specific purposes, but I'm not a person on Twitter, so there's my bias out there. Once upon a time, politicians would use things like grabs, controlling access to themselves, if they had status, to control time. Right? You want to, like, if the story is evolving the way you don't want it to evolve, if you give nothing, or you only give something, or a specific sort of thing, that's all they've got, and you can attempt to influence that. When politicians get onto Twitter, they instantly get locked into the flow. That is just like you are totally locked to the news cycle because you're always responding to stuff. Very few, occasionally they do, but very few stories actually come out of Twitter. Twitter's a place of kind of discourse about whatever's the current thing. And I think
that... Or breakfast.
That's right. And everything has that kind of equal standing, right?
Yeah.
And so I think that means that the capacity to use different media to control the temporal flow of things is problematic. And we used to, and this is where, you know, I can get all kind of like self-reflective, but, we used to say, politician websites are so terrible because they're just static repositories, right? And then, like, of course, now we've got Twitter, it's like, these repositories are kind of useful because they're like static repositories. You could, like, what is their policy on X? Not, you know, what are they having for dinner or where are they or whatever. So I think that is an emerging area of practice. We've certainly seen that in the rest of the world, where Facebook means it's really difficult to keep the separation.
Mm-hmm.
And there are emerging literacies about this. But certainly at the moment, and this is why I did turn to a red, because I was thinking about the rise of the social, for example, about how those inversions occur. We used to know what was private and what was public, and what was public-private. So you were standing in a train, picking your nose, right? It was public, but everyone was supposed to act like it was private. Now, with social media, we don't, you know, like, if your boss sees a picture of you on a Saturday night drinking, right, theoretically, he should pretend that he doesn't know it, but, you know, it's all very ambiguous because we've mushed that all together. Whether we'll be able to disentangle, I mean, the Facebook phenomena will end either by Facebook becoming very different to what it is today or resolving some of these sort of things. And they have tried to do this, various technologies, by putting different people into lists. These are friends, these are not very good friends, these are Facebook friends only, these are workmates, this is the vicar, you know, and stuff like that. But I don't think, in a sense, we've got there with that. And politicians who, yeah, do have many roles to play. The problem for them, of course, is, like we've seen with Anthony Weiner, for example, how much self-control do you have? How can you really be on guard all the time? For this paper, I have the word cop block in this paper to describe some strategy with regards to open office. So I attempted to cop block Microsoft, right? And my wife went through and she said, no, you can't say that in Parliament. And I was like, you're right, that'd be wrong to say. But imagine if I had my wife follow me around. I mean, like I'm from Queensland, you know, with straight shooters. I could never be a politician, right? So I think that's a problem. Now, over time, that will adjust. But in the meantime, we have all these ambiguities, and we're seeing those ambiguities emerge. But in terms of policymaking, I think the problem we have is, because of the sense of risk, we place a lot of these projects into the pilot stage, and because they're in the pilot stage, no one wants to use them. And then we go, oh, they're rubbish. You know, what's the point of that? And we've certainly seen that. I mean, Tasmania had a statewide consultation arena, Victoria had. The only one that sort of stayed up was Queensland, very structured. You know, and things like that for any long period of time. Lots of local governments had it, and they just said, well, why don't people just log in and talk about trash and dogs on parks? Stuff like that. It's like, well, people don't want to talk about that stuff, really. They just want you to do it.
One last question. Thank you.
Sorry.
Just probably changing tack a little bit. Let's just pretend for a second that we've got openness, transparency, and engagement in politics. The perfect openness, transparency, and engagement. Is that actually a good thing? Could we, if that happens, see politics becoming very reactionary, having perverse outcomes, because you'll be over-consulting, everyone will have an opinion, it'll trivialise, and also it'll stretch timelines because you're supposed to engage, you're supposed to be very open, and then we'll see things like focusing on the irrelevancies of what he said, she said, rather than putting together policy in the traditional sense of coming up with an idea, discussing it, consulting, figuring out whether it's a good thing or not, and then just doing it.
Yes, is the short answer. I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I guess there are two sides to that. The first is, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, look at the MySchools thing. I mean, the first thing that that Hum did was re-engineer the MySchools site to create league tables, even though the government said we don't want to create league tables because they're a bad instrument. We know they're a bad instrument. They punish schools that need assistance, and they don't really tell you anything, right? On the flip side, of course, is WikiLeaks. Right. If you think about it, what is that one area of policy making that people actually really talk about? And Australians don't talk about politics. You know, like, this is the other thing about the, you know, public sphere. Of course, less than 5% of Australians will actively try to convince someone to change their country in an election. We just don't talk about politics. We're not really a bumper sticker t-shirt wearing culture like the liberal American culture. But one area of politics that people do talk about is international affairs, and it's the most opaque area. So it's very unsurprising that WikiLeaks' most prominent kind of expose, so if you go to its website, it's got information on all sorts of stuff, crazy mad stuff. But the one that really gets attention is that area of policy that people are genuinely interested in. So there is obviously a balance to be reached there. And I think if we look at, and regardless of your politics, I think if we look at the current government's handling of the carbon tax thing, I think this is a classic example. They have attempted, in a sort of way, to keep a narrative control over that. It's a classic kind of PR state kind of move. And they are being eaten alive on that one. And my assumption is, I just think people are too dumb. Because they don't want to say, you know, like, they don't want to say, well, one of the reasons prices for electricity is going up is because the market has uncertainty and they're factoring their uncertainty in. As soon as we get certainty, that'll resolve it one way or another, right? Like, this is like basic economics. And they just, you know, just won't have that kind of discussion with the public.
Or it's not being published.
Well, it's not being published, but I don't think it's really coming out. And and the other thing is what are the kind of, you know, what the kind of parliamentary environment looks like. Like, you know, the government's getting hit left, right and centre for not having an answer it can't have. And I don't think, you know, people really understand that. So I think the PR state model is problematic. There is a reason why it exists, and Kevin Rudd knows that reason, because if you, you know, refuse to engage in that kind of government advertising campaign, someone with money will do it. And that is the reality. So one, obviously, yes, you're right. The other hand is that people want to gain access to information about particular policy areas. And the second is this data is not going to stay in secret, particularly stuff that people are interested about. Politicians once were the ones to use strategic leaks, right? That instrument, that political, and that was a very useful political tool. So if you go back to Rob Tiffin's classic book, News and Power, you know, he's got a whole chapter about selective leaking, right? Well, governments can still do that, but now all sorts of other people can do that much more easily. I think I didn't answer the question, actually.
But it was a very interesting set of answers. I think the answers here have been more interesting than we've had at any parliamentary library lecture or vital issues seminar. And I think it's just an incredibly important conversation and very useful for us to see something to balance some of the missionary zeal that we see around Gov 2.0 at times. So I'd like to thank Peter very much, and thank you for your questions. Thank you.
And my full paper will be available with my email address on.
Brilliant.
For comments. So it's just transparent.
Thank you.
Please, I mean, I really enjoyed it. And unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to do it. That's a great. Yeah, absolutely. But I was thinking.
Thanks.
Sorry,
I didn't really answer your question.
No.
I suppose my anecdote would be, it's like going to the doctor with a cancer.
Absolutely.
The doctor says, whereas if they were open, honest and transparent, then they'd say, you know, you're pretty much rooted, you're going to do it anyway. That has can have perverse outcomes, I suppose. And the same with politics. If we get there and we tell people exactly what we're doing and why we're doing it.
The medical analogy is a really good one, though, because, I mean, if you think about it, the patients' rights movement emerges in the 1960s, right? Mm. Where does it come from? It comes from feminists. Why does it come from feminists? Feminists complain about the contraceptive pill, the first contraceptive pill. Why do they complain about the first contraceptive pill? It's a massive single dose of progesterone. Why is it a massive single dose of progesterone? Sorry. Because doctors who had no transparency did the most dodgy testing in the third world.
Good, can I even take
and
a trip?
Yeah, it creates problems. And the classic doctor's done is placebo, which we know. I mean, placebo is the old standard.
It works in 20, anything will work in 20
Well, that's right.
I mean, I'm confused. The other question is the new media and the new way of politicians interacting with people.